You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
Welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of the Body Pro. Right now, I'm in the poster session where researchers are standing in front of their posters. There's nothing like hearing the results of research directly from those who have actually conducted the research. It is these women and men who are transforming HIV treatment and care. In this podcast, the researchers will introduce themselves and then summarize their study. After their summary, I'll ask a few questions. Accompanying me on this interview is Dr. Gerald Perrone, a clinician and researcher who is the director of the AIDS Research and Treatment Center of the Treasure Coast in Fort Pierce, Florida.
I'm Lisa Hirshhorn, and I'm with JSI Research and Training and Harvard Medical School. And this was a study that was funded by HRSA through the SPINS program to explore whether you could actually replicate a positive prevention intervention that had been proven in a clinical trial at a single site into real-life practice at 15 Ryan White care-supported sites. And so we collaborated actually with the original developers from the University of Connecticut and took their research protocol and the research instruments they had, and from that developed a training and a manual that could then be rolled out to sites. And 15 sites actually applied and were given small amounts of funding to help them implement the intervention. And so we did one centralized training, and then people were provided with resources to actually then train other providers at their site and to implement what's called the options intervention, which is a brief clinician-based positive prevention intervention. It's sort of based on the whole idea of giving people information and then motivating them to decide what they want to actually do to either maintain low risk or decrease active risk.
What kind of information do they give?
So they go through actually a risk assessment. So they ask them, there's actually sort of we ended up with seven steps. So the first thing they do is they assess what kind of risk behavior they're actually having right now. Then they negotiate with the patient which area they want to discuss for risk behavior discussion, either for reduction or maintenance of low risk. They focus then on what are the areas that might put somebody at risk. So when do you not use condoms? So when you're drinking or using drugs? And then they talk about if you wanted to change this or maintain it, how important is it to you? And the patient rates it from 1 to 10. And how confident are you that you can actually make the change? And then based on that, so if they say, for example, I think it's only a 3, they sort of say, well, why is it a 3? Why do you care at all? Why is it important at all? And how can we make this more important for you? And then they discuss strategies, how to reduce the specific risk or to maintain the low risk. Like, you know, what are you going to do the next time that you drink? They agree upon a goal, which is a progressive goal. So if you're never using condoms, could you use them some of the time? And then they, in the next appointment, they follow up on the discussion, and it's documented in what's called the patient record form so that it becomes a permanent part of the record. And what we found is that 13 out of the 15 clinics were able to implement it, and 90% of the patients reported having the risk discussion after they had an option visit. So most of them, they thought very positive. They thought that providers' comfort and knowledge seemed to improve. And it took only a median was about 5 minutes, which was much less than people thought it was going to be.
To go through
the whole thing, yeah. The providers selected, to some extent, who was going to be able to get it. So, for example, they avoided people who had really very significant mental illness, such as psychoses, people who were only coming in with crisis, who were really very actively high. So it had to be people who were engaging in primary care. I mean, this was really meant to be an intervention that capitalized on the relationship between a patient and their primary care provider.
So who typically did this work?
So it would have to be whoever the primary care provider was, the doc, the nurse practitioner, or the physician's assistant. One of the sites actually had in place already some very good prevention educators, and so they actually implemented it using the prevention educators, which was not sort of within the context of this, and probably in the next, it was this balance between fidelity and adaptation, and so they adapted it more than sticking with the fidelity. There was a lot of debate whether that's an okay thing to do, and you could argue on two different levels, one of which is that it's the person who you have the closest relationship to, but because this was meant to be a repetitive sort of chronic care management approach, the feeling it was more appropriate to have somebody with whom you were going to have repeated ongoing contacts.
Now, could you tell me a little bit about the demographics?
Sure. So it was, we, like the original study, had very, very few people who were self-reported injection drug users, and even fewer who had active drug use. So about half of the people self-reported MSM as a risk, and a significant number of other ones were heterosexual. About a quarter of the people had less than a high school graduation, and most of the people had actually been positive for quite a long time. Median was about seven years, although the range was anywhere from less than a year to as high as 28 years by self-report. Very high rates of active mental illness, 42%. But what was interesting was qualitatively we went and talked to the providers, and even the patients that had been in care with the provider for many years, when they went through this discussion, there was all kinds of risk behavior that they hadn't known was going on. And some of them said, oh, I'm so glad that we're talking about sex now. And the providers had clearly been giving positive prevention messages all along, but somehow it wasn't quite getting through. And the other thing that was fascinating was because this forces you to talk about issues about strategies to reduce or maintain low risk, a number of the patients who reported abstinence were not abstinent by choice, but actually had medical conditions that they had been too embarrassed to actually talk about. And so it invoked these discussions, and a number of patients sort of had medical evaluations about, when they found, uncovered some medical problems about why people were actually having erectile dysfunction as a result of this. So it was interesting in the sense of not only opening up a discussion for positive prevention, but also probably improving the discussion that they were having with the patients in general.
Right. It's kind of challenging, though, for most clinicians to find the time to do this, even if it just takes 5
right.
minutes. But
right.
They don't have the time. So how feasible is this, really?
Well, so this was one of the main concerns, and I think there was a fair amount of initial resistance. But we actually, when we went to the clinics, it really did not disrupt the ongoing clinic. You have to have at least 20 minutes and ideally a little bit more for a visit. If you have a 12-minute visit, you're not going to have time to do this. But it has to be a priority, and, you know, given the CDC recommendations and issues about ongoing transmission, feeling is this has to become a priority. And the clinicians really felt like it improved the communication that they had with their patients overall. So you definitely have to undergo a certain amount of resistance, but we talked to the administrators as well as the clinicians, and people felt it really hadn't disrupted the patient flow. One of the key things is that when people implement this, is you don't implement it all at once to every patient. So the idea is you do it for one or two patients at each session, because the first interaction takes longer than the follow-up ones. And so the idea is you start off and you sort of do two or three at each session, preferably once, you know, sort of a little bit towards the beginning, and then over time you actually end up interacting with all the patients.
Uh-huh. Oh, hi, I'm Jerry Perrone from AIDS Research and Treatment Center of the Treasure Coast. You mentioned overcoming the initial resistance. How long did it actually take to get the clinicians and the administrative staff and the support staff in these clinics on board and trained to do this?
It was delayed. It's a little bit difficult to assess that because we had other delays, for example, IRB approvals and getting the training. Once the training went into place, it didn't take very long, mostly because each site, with the exception of one site, had a very dedicated leader who came in, and they started doing it usually with one other person, and then they would do training and would spread out from the clinic. So I think one of the keys to success, and this is one of the reasons why one of the sites didn't work, was you had to have somebody who was committed and who felt that this was going to be done. And in general, they wanted it to be a physician. A couple of the sites were able to do it with nurse practitioners, but it had to be somebody with enough leadership and authority that they could say this is what's going to happen. And some of the sites, it took a couple of months for some of the providers to actually do buy-in. And then even some of the most resistant ones, by the end of it, really thought that it was very helpful. And the majority of the sites are continuing to do it in some manner or another.
The 50% of sexually active patients who reported that they used condom, was that considered low or high? And that was before the intervention, right?
That was considered to be low. Because these were, most of these were sites where they already were doing some sort of positive prevention, so I think people were very surprised that it was low.
Uh-huh.
And everybody had made the assumption that it was actually higher, although there was some serosorting going on in terms of condom use.
Uh-huh. It sounds like, from what you're describing, that no matter what, that positive things came out of these interventions, that medical conditions were uncovered, dialogue occurred which hadn't been happening, mm-hmm. clinicians became aware of their patients' sexual activities when perhaps they weren't before. So even if outcomes weren't particularly changed, those outcomes on a clinician were positively impacted.
That was our impression. I mean, obviously it's qualitative. The one of the limitations of the study was that it took 18 months to actually be proven effective in the research setting, and because of issues of delay with IRB approval and then also duration of funding that was available, we were only actually able to assess at 3 months, although even at 3 months we began to see changes in terms of reducing sexual risk reduction or maintaining low-risk behavior.
Could you talk a little bit about the impact? I see you have a bunch of numbers there.
Yeah, so we did it first. We said how many of these people actually achieved their risk reduction goal, and it was 68%. So two-thirds of people, even at 3 months, were able to achieve what their goal was, and 85% either decreased risk or maintained low or no risk. And it was interesting, one of the biggest challenging people were the people actually that were having low or no risk. And how do you actually discuss that with patients in terms of encouraging them to continue to maintain that? And people felt like this helped them do that. And we saw slightly better in terms of maintaining low risk or increasing condom use among HIV negative or unknown partners than among HIV positive partners. And the trend we saw to decrease of non-injection drug use is to get high, particularly in the context of sexual behavior. We had very, very little injection drug use, but fairly substantial amounts of other substances without a prescription or alcohol to get high, as 55%. And when we did some exit interviews of patients, they reported that they thought that the provider knowledge of sexual activities and recreational drugs improved, even though this was a group of patients who had a fairly high baseline knowledge, as did the providers. They somehow, the communication sort of in some subtle ways seemed to get better as well.
Can you see taking this research one step further, where you could show a lower rate of sexually transmitted diseases among people, lower rates of hospitalization for mm-hmm. psychiatric comorbidity, et cetera? Better control of viral replication?
Yeah, I think the sexually transmitted infections is going to be tough because the rates are very, very low documented in the chart. And this is, we do some quality work in some other states and have found the same sort of thing, probably because some patients go and get treated elsewhere. And most other studies, it's been very difficult to actually show a decline in that. I think it's in terms of other sort of biological outcomes, I think it would be interesting to see whether there is any impact in terms of adherence as a result, for example, of decreased recreational drug use. The mental illness is an interesting question. Clearly, some of the main barriers that people felt was this very high rate of active mental illness and some of the limitations in terms of getting adequate treatment for it. The providers did not do this, again, for patients who were really had very, very severe mental illness, so people that were actively psychotic. You know, you had to have sort of be grounded a little bit in reality to actually undergo this sort of motivational behavior change. So I don't know if the highest risk patients are actually going to necessarily be the ones for whom this is appropriate. And some of them aren't even showing up to get general medical care. So this is really meant to be much more within the context of patients that are coming into care and how do you actually make them sort of safer in terms of what they do.
That's a good question. I'm a clinician at Walker. So your interventions, is there a behavioral questionnaire that the nurse can ask?
It was actually developed more as something that is part of the conversation that they're having with the primary care provider. So it wasn't sort of a risk assessment, which is what's next door to you, right?
Yes, exactly.
Where the doctor sort of says, "Oh, you told the nurse this and that." It forced the primary care provider, doctor, nurse practitioner, to actually have that discussion. And they felt that that was actually one of the things that helped because, first of all, it validated it. It was, it's important my doctor or my nurse practitioner is talking about it. And it also allowed them to sort of continue on as a conversation of just, so it says you're doing this and that. They felt it was a much more of a building conversation.
Yeah, I think I find some screening questions, usually 20 minutes appointment, and mm-hmm. most of the time there are some other priorities mm-hmm. on the list.
Yeah.
And if someone was asking before they get to us some screening questions, then you can focus on the area that needs to be. You don't tell them, you know, this is what you told the nurse, but, you know, you already identified by just glancing at it, okay, this is a risk area that I probably should spend more time on. Time is the ultimate
right.
Factor.
No, I agree.
I think on everything is
yes.
the time.
No, I agree. And that's why if you're less than 20 minutes, you can't do it. Yeah. But the feeling was because this doesn't... you know, for some patients it's going to need to be done every time, for other ones not necessarily, although in the original protocol it was, that it's not a lot of time and it is something that has a major impact. And you're supposed to focus, it's actually where, which area you focus on is a negotiation. So as opposed to saying, me as your doctor, this is what we're going to talk about, you sort of say, okay, there's a bunch of different areas here, which do you want to talk about? And even though it may not be the one that you think is the most important, it's a way, again, of this whole idea that it's a gradual change, so that it's information, motivation, and then behavior change over time, as opposed to a one time, here's a problem, let's fix it today, and then move on. So it's, again, it's much more based in a chronic care management approach, the same way you would do with diabetes. So it would be something that you would say, this is, to get their A1C down is going to be a long process. And so the idea is that to look at this as a change that can take 18 months to get somebody down.
How many visits, maybe every 3 months if they came, this would have been the year results for us?
Talking to the providers, it seemed as if somebody was low risk, and you know, particularly if they were maintaining abstinent and they were abstinent by choice, that probably once or twice and then yearly, I mean, was sort of the general feeling about it. Because otherwise you're sort of beating somebody over the head when they're maintaining it. So it's just a question of, have things changed, and is this a struggle for you, and things like that. But for people that were actively engaging in higher risk behavior, for them it would be something that would be a constant, you know, an ongoing conversation.
Now, when your providers, were they surprised how much they learned by this training that you had?
The qualitative feedback was that they learned a lot, even though these were very, very, some of them were very experienced in terms of positive prevention and things like that. But even, it was sort of how to talk about it was something that they thought was very helpful.
Kind of
And the patients reported that their knowledge got better.
Did you provide actual language for how people should talk to their patients about this?
Yeah, so some of it in the training was sort of language, and how do you, and when people say this, how do you respond to it?
So real dialogue, real, you know, practice sessions.
Right, yeah.
That was great.
It will be eventually, yeah.
And are you planning a website that we can direct readers to?
Yeah, so there's the careacttarget.org, which is the HRSA website, and then University of Connecticut, I think, is going to have another website that used to be up that's come down, but it's going to hopefully go back up again. But the information should be available through the Care Act Target site.
So a clinic could go to careacttarget.org and download this information to implement.
Yeah, it's not up right yet, but it's going to be. It's going to be a manual.
Great.
It's HRSA through the SPINS.
Okay, great.
Initiative.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.